Welcome to Liberating Libraries, an audio project by the Conspiracy of Equality. In this series, we take a look at some of our favorite authors and ask how their works of fiction might inform, enhance, or guide our own thinking about the world and our activism. We believe that when done well, fiction foments invention. It is where we get to try our hands at being attuned to alternatives. Sometimes it fails, and it's always imperfect. But at any moment, it can be the source of solidarity, equality, and freedom. In this episode, we're talking about Swing Time by Zadie Smith. Swing Time follows the story of a young Black girl and later woman in London and her relationships to her childhood friend Tracy, her activist mother, and later her pop star boss Aimé. It's told from her perspective, though she is never named and remains a rather incomplete character on the page. She meets Tracy in dance class when they're young, and though their lives take wildly different directions, they keep looping back together. As a young adult, she's a PA for Aimé, who is building a school for girls in an unnamed African country. The story jumps around a lot in time, but is told largely as reflections by the narrator on different moments from her past. Although it's a bit confusing to summarize, it's a really intricate examination of power, class, race, and personal relationships under neoliberal capitalism.
You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Okay, well, you wanted to start with these words that describe your feelings about it, which you have thought about and I have not, so...
So,
take it away.
Yes, you're right. Like, as I was driving the bus one day, I was just like, what are the two words that you could use to describe Swing Time by Zadie Smith? And I think for her other books, that is not an easy task. And not that I think this is necessarily an easier task, but there were two that jumped out into my head. Like, every time I was thinking about this book, there were two that just really jumped out at me. And one of them is power, and the other one is ambiguity.
Hmm. I like that. I like that a lot. And I know you have lots to say about both of those words.
I know, amazingly enough.
I did not think as deeply about two words because I'm a verbose person and can't come up with two words for anything. But when I was thinking about it, I was interpreting your question to be more about, like, how did the book make you feel in a couple words? And the one word that I could think of that really stuck with me was familiarity. Mm-hmm. And I think this is maybe just the difference between us as readers of this book. Like, for me, reading Zadie is always, and I'm going to call her Zadie because I'm a terrible person, and...
Well, really, we're just best friends with Zadie, so...
We are so tight with Zadie right now. I spend a lot of time watching her interviews and reading her stuff and thinking about the things she says. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that I just feel really... I feel like she's one of the few writers I've encountered in my life whose experiences feel really close to a lot of my own experiences. Being mixed race, being brought up in a way that foregrounded education and foregrounded, like, striving for betterment and striving for achievement, but also then came up against all of the problems that race and class pose for those sort of aims and goals. So I think Swing Time is the book that most felt that way to me. Of just, there were moments in that book where I was reading it thinking, this is so exactly like things that I have gone through. And it was just a very comforting form of familiarity, even at the same time that it was so uncomfortable and so grotesque at points to, like, grapple with. So our first piece of the conversation that we wanted to talk about is really about, like, how this book grapples with issues that I think Zadie Smith talks about in all of her books, but how maybe Swing Time does those a little bit differently, and particularly around its more explicit politics, and its more explicit discussion about class, and of course about the intersections of class and race. So I wrote in the notes about how, like, we've both read all of her novels, and we've both commented in the past how her first book, White Teeth, and some of her or her earlier stuff didn't really talk as directly about class and didn't seem to sort of unpack how class relations were impacting the sort of choices that her characters had available to them and their reactions to things. But that more recently, with Northwest NW and with this book, Swing Time, she seems to have developed a really strong political voice at the same time that it's this beautiful fiction, right? Like, it still remains really beautiful, compelling, ambiguous, as you said, ambivalent fiction, and yet it has a really strong political voice. So I think that's a good place for us to start.
I think I would just agree with you. Like, I think, like, especially, like, if you look at, like, On Beauty, I don't think the class politics are quite there, because it's coming from, like, an upper middle class kind of, like, competition in an academic setting. But yeah, like, definitely with Northwest and Swing Time, there is this, it's really about the lives of the working class, but not just, like, kind of the lives generically, like, in White Teeth, but it's, like, she is, seems to be really trying to make an argument on class and the ability to move in and out of class, and the ramifications that that happens, and the limits that are available for individuals to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. Like, I think it is new. Not necessarily new for Sadie, but I think it's very clear, especially in Swing Time, what we're talking about, that she tries to pose these different limits around class and race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, the limits in White Teeth are very clearly there around race.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know. But, I mean, she has talked in her discussions about Swing Time and about NW about writing them as stories about, in some way, what might have been, because she grew up in Northwest London. She grew up in, I don't know if she grew up in social housing, but she grew up in sort of that region, surrounded by people who were living in sort of different economic conditions, living in social housing, living in poverty, whatever. And it talks about how both Swing Time and Northwest are in some ways stories about the path that she might have gone down had she not gone down this path of getting accepted to Cambridge and becoming a writer and becoming a very successful writer.
And a successful writer at a very young age.
Very young age.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the characters in NW and in Swing Time, you can kind of see her writing in some ways alternative selves.
Hmm.
And I just think that's really interesting as a way for her to grapple with class, because it makes it not just sort of a bird's eye view of working class life, like you're saying, but rather an intimate sort of, almost, it almost feels like it could be very painful to go through, like this intimate kind of like, what could have happened? But I think that the biggest question that it raises is what is she ultimately saying about the possibilities of escaping,
mm-hmm.
or like leaving behind the barriers and boundaries of working class, of being working class, because there's a lot of emphasis in Swing Time on the sort of opportunities that education might afford to the narrator, the main character, or, you know, how she's trying to build her career to go to get out of Northwest London. And it doesn't really work very well for her. I think the question that arose for me is, how does Zadie actually feel about this neoliberal aspiration to become a successful individual and to move out of the boundaries of collective social groupings like class or race or gender or whatever by becoming a successful individual? Is she sending it up? Is she like highlighting it as the possibility that exists? I mean, is it being a very pessimistic view or an optimistic view? Like, what's her relationship to that narrative?
So I thought it was really clear when I was reading it that she is, she's poking at it and just really pulling it apart and kind of I don't know if I'd say destroying, but, like, she's being ambiguous about it at the very least. And I think you can look at this through, like, kind of, like, the different lens. So, like, right, you have the narrator who does get a job and, you know, for a small time, it's hard to say, well, she'd be successful. She's financially successful and living a very non-working class life. You have her mother who believes that education is absolutely everything, and that is the driving point for her to get her out of the council housing. And she does. She becomes a city councillor, and then she becomes, like, a member of parliament. But I don't think she's ever happy. I don't think, like, she ends up dying in the end of the book, and she dies alone. Like, there's nobody else around her. Her father, who at the start of the book is, like, middle management in the postal service, and he, like, has a fairly happy life. But then when the narrator's mother leaves him to try to win her back, he takes a lesser job to, like, be able to try to go to education, and it just ends up going really poorly for him. Like, he ends up being, like, quite poor and very unhappy. And then there's Tracy. And, like, Tracy does not live a good life. Tracy lives a very hard life. But at the end of the book, Tracy is really the only one who's happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, like, I think that's kind of how she's playing with it, right? She's saying that, like, it's almost like this emphasis to become an individual, to become something that, trying to get away from what you think you are. You may find some type of success in it, and education might be the route through success, but that success doesn't guarantee your happiness. So I think that's how she's playing it, where it's just like, you know, the neoliberal aspiration to become all this is that you go to education, you'll get a better job, you'll have more financial success, and ultimately you're going to live a happier life. Mm-hmm. And I think for Zadie in this book, that's not what's happening. I think happiness does not come at all through education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think it's also interesting the way that she points this out in sort of two parallel kind of criticisms or two parallel ways, where you've got the sort of the structural flaw of the neoliberal aspiration for the individual, where it's like it's made very clear throughout the narrative that that individual achievement or an individual success doesn't actually make the community any better, right? So the narrator's mother, who spends all this time bettering herself in an effort to better her community and in an effort to be the sort of political leader of change, ultimately, like, runs up against the intractability of a lot of those structures of capitalism. Like, she herself can't actually run the revolution. She herself can't overthrow everything. And her individual betterment, or the betterment of individuals within the community, is not, it's not enough. But I think the bigger picture of that comes from Amy, right? Mm-hmm. The story about there's this international pop star that the narrator becomes one of the assistants to, who is sort of modeled on this, you know, this figure that's very similar to Madonna or to someone like that, Cher, Oprah Winfrey, whatever, who tries to better the world by picking an individual isolated location of a problem and bettering that location, right? So we're going to build a school in this particular location as a way to better the situation of structural inequality and poverty in the world. And of course, that's a failure and is never actually going to achieve equality or liberation for anybody, because even for the people who end up getting better educations, like, their possibilities that exist outside of that school remain structurally unequal. And so there's that, like, that failure of the individual narrative of neoliberalism. But then what I think is really great about Zadie is the way that she brings that into these very personal, intimate levels of failure, where it's like it's failure on these very base psychological, emotional, like, levels of being, right? Like, it's the failure of this narrative to actually reach our humanity, in a sense, because and I think this goes back to the way in which the narrator isn't a character in the book, right? Doesn't have doesn't really have a defined set of personality traits, doesn't have a name, doesn't have an identity that's really firmly established. And it's a lot of it seems to come back to this idea of like the failure of the things that she's grasping at to form her identity become this like this very personal vacuum of identity for her, right? Like neoliberalism evacuates of us of our humanity on a very, very intimate way and in a very like societal way.
I think you're right. Like she doesn't really have that identity except when she has her interactions with Tracy.
Yes.
Right? And then, like, so when she meets up with Tracy after all of these years of, like, separation, there's always that kind of, like, she almost becomes a different person again. And a person who can be more comfortable in herself, and is almost uncomfortable, more uncomfortable with the skin that she's in. So I'm just thinking of when she goes on her, like, blind date that Amy has set her up on, and sees that Tracy is acting in this play, like, dancing in this play. And she forces this guy to go there, and like she's just enthralled by Tracy being up on this stage,
mm-hmm.
that she kind of ignores like this other part of her life that like is happening, because she just so desires being back in that space of like being back in and seeing this dance happening between her and Tracy.
Or at the very least desires the feeling of being a person that she got from being with Tracy.
Yeah.
Even though there's, like, problems with their relationship, like, even when they're kids, there's, like, clear, unhealthy dynamics in their relationship. She is the most person she is in the book, right, when she's around Tracy.
Yeah.
And it's almost like there's a longing there, right?
Yeah.
Like, a longing to have that and the lack of possibility to fulfill it. Then the other piece of this that I wrote about was Amy's role in this. So I was talking about how Amy is like a model or an example of these like the structural hole in our humanity, our impossibility of achieving liberation through neoliberal betterment and through capitalism, essentially. So I'm not sure that Zadie Smith would ever use any of these words to explain what she means, but
think
like
she would either.
It's there. But then I also reflect on Amy being this like clear embodiment of white supremacy and the interconnection between white supremacy and neoliberalism, right? Because Amy is this white Australian pop star who sucks up the labor and love and energy of everyone around her, but also appropriates a lot of the labor and love of people of color.
Mm.
And particularly, you see this dynamic play out in relation to building the school in it is an unnamed African country, I think, but it's supposed to be based on, I think, the Gambia.
Yeah.
Where, like, it's clear that she's also, at the same time that she's trying to do something good, and I put that in air quotes, she's also appropriating both the good feeling that comes from that, but also the like actual cultural content of the place that she's gone to.
She takes dances, and the narrator explains that while they're in this place, she is very interested in all the different types of dancing that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So you see Amy actually take that into it, and she starts doing music videos and doing her own dances with like this West African feel to them, and she buys a baby, right?
Yes.
Right? Like,
there's no other way to say it. She buys a baby.
She buys a baby. It's adopted in air quotes, but it's adopted through a purchase.
Yes.
Right? So like yeah, you actually see that where yeah, it is like the literal her like taking on kind of like all of these things about this place that she's trying to help, which just betters her, right? Like, it actually enriches her and makes her more wealthier. Whereas what you're seeing in the community is that the government almost walks away from the community while... Because, like, there's all this publicity going in and all of this. Great job. This is amazing. It's going to be a school for girls. But then the country is just like, well, why... Like, we also don't need to do roads because she can just come in and fix the roads in your community. Or we're not going to actually better the schools for what are now going to be the boys because she can just do that, right? So, like, there is this, like, yeah, so she does her own little thing, gets her own betterment, while leaving it so much worse for the community that she's actually trying to help.
So just a quick cut in, this is where we started linking the previous discussion to talking about the narrator and her relationship to her own relationships. And we begin with a passage from the text.
This is what I understood by it, that for Astaire, the person in the film was not especially connected with him. And I took this to heart, or rather, it echoed a feeling I already had. Mainly that it was important to treat oneself as a kind of stranger, to remain unattached and unprejudiced in your own case. I thought you needed to think like that to achieve anything in this world. Yes, I thought that was a very elegant attitude, and I became fixated, too, upon Katharine Hepburn's famous Fred and Ginger theory. He gives her class, she gives him sex. Was this a general rule? Did all friendships, all relations, involve this discreet and mysterious exchange of qualities, this exchange of power? Did it extend to peoples or nations, or was that a thing that happened only between individuals? What did my father give my mother, and vice versa? What did Mr. Booth and I give each other? What did I give Tracy? What did Tracy give me? I think, you get this narrative from the narrator of her just kind of telling the story, but not, like, it's almost like she's detached from the story that she's telling, even though it's the story of her life. And, like, I think from that, you almost get a sense of melancholy from the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just, like, she's just not happy. And she, like, she's just trying to understand her life as to what has led her to this situation. And again, if you're only seeing your life in power relations, and you're only understanding all your relationships in power relations, like, where does that leave you at the end of it?
Mm-hmm. And not just as power relations, as transactions.
As transactions, yeah.
Right? Which is this very capitalist way of understanding
mm-hmm.
our relationships to each other, that we just have transactions with each other. And
yeah.
We measure our relationship based on either the cost-benefit analysis or the reciprocity analysis
mm-hmm.
or whatever it is.
And it kind of goes back into, like, the idea of the neoliberal sense of, like, trying to become this individual of greatness, that if all your relationships are just transactions, then you're always trying to get the better of the transaction,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you're trying to better yourself, not trying to figure out a way to better each other. And, like, Emmy absolutely does that. She uses all of her interactions with everybody around her to benefit herself,
mm-hmm.
as we had just said. Whereas, like, the narrator,
it's like she doesn't know how to do that,
yeah.
but thinks that she should be doing it, and
yeah.
so feels like very unsuccessful and unable to fulfill what she thinks she needs to, but then that doesn't actually fill her up with any meaning either. Okay, so this leads us to talking about this theme of power in relationships more broadly.
Yeah.
And so you feel like the entire book is about power in relationships.
Yeah, I do. Like, I don't know how you could read it and not see it about power in relationships, right? Like, the obvious one that we've talked about is Amy and her mother. But then you also have the power relationship between Tracy and the narrator, where Tracy is the one with all the ideas and without the fear of ever getting caught or getting in trouble with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, like, peer pressures the narrator into doing a lot when they were younger.
Mm-hmm.
When the narrator is older and Tracy is, like, harassing her mother as MP, where she has to go in and try to, like, calm, like, get Tracy to stop doing this, you see kind of, like, a little bit of reversal there, where the narrator sees herself as better than Tracy at this particular point. So, like, there's a power relationship there, which then, again, becomes inverted, like, later on. You have power relationships between the mother and the narrator. There are no positive power relationships. I think, like, maybe you could see it between the narrator and the narrator's father. I think they have a better relationship of, like, a father-daughter relationship that's a little bit more equal and a little bit more understanding and supportive of each other, that ends up falling apart because Tracy
implodes it,
right?
Yeah.
There's no like I think it's all about power in these relationships that he's talking about, and it's power that's like just explicit of one power over the person, be it the power of like manipulation or like the power to deceive and stuff like that, or like the racial power as we like talked about with Emmy and like her ability to collect all of these different people of color around her to like like make herself better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what do you think of that? Like, so, like, do you not see the power, the different power relationships in the book?
I definitely see it. I don't think, I think I needed you and I needed Zadie Smith to tell me that, to like, point out the sort of, the continuity of that weave throughout the whole story.
Mm.
Because I don't think I necessarily picked up on it quite that way. But I think it's so powerful once I saw it, I was like, yes, that is what makes this make sense. that's what ties all of these stories together. And at first I was like, doesn't this make it in some ways a very pessimistic book? Because like all of these relationships are only able to be defined through power and like, so in one of the interviews she's given about it, Zadie Smith has talked about how like a lot of what influenced writing the book was seeing all the clientelist relationships that exist in our modern economy. So where you have like, you know, she talks about how, or you have like young people working as interns basically for free for wealthy and famous people because that they believe that they're going to get something out of it that's going to lead them to a better life. Mm-hmm. And then you also have like clientelism between countries or between celebrities and the countries that they use, right? Where it's like, again, like we talked about, where they're using each other, but there's clearly such a power imbalance that the one side, the white supremacy side, is always going to get more out of it. And it's just like, does that end up making it a very pessimistic book? But then, and then I was thinking about what you had written about the ending of the book, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's something really happy about the ending of the book. I mean, it's not happy because the narrator's mother dies and she chooses not to go visit her mother that day and instead go visit Tracy. I mean, she doesn't know her mother's going to die that day, but
yeah.
She chooses to visit Tracy. And the very last scene is her watching Tracy with her children just being happy and dancing.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you can almost picture nice end of movie moment where there's like this warm door open for the narrator to kind of like bring her into herself almost. After all the shit that even Tracy was implicated in, all the shit that happened to the narrator. But yeah. The door is just like, there's this like warm door open with that scene of them dancing on the balcony. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think that's, like, I think that's really good. Yeah, which doesn't shock me that that's, like, how Zadie Smith would end it, being that it's based on Swing Time. Like, not based on Swing Time, but, like, so much of the 1930s and 40s movies are, like, so prevalent in the movie. But, yeah, like, I think it's, like, because it is depressing. Like, the book is not a happy book, right?
Like, no.
Like, it's super depressing, and I think, like, you can see, like, I like the idea of the clientelism, like running through all these relationships, and you can see so much of that in the way we live, and it is such a product of neoliberalism.
Well, it's the transaction-based relationship.
It's the transaction-based relationship economy. The relationship between her and Tracy is so fraught, and the narrator is never happier than when she's with her, and never more angry and upset than when she's with her. And maybe that's real, like that type of like, you, like that is like a real relationship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's the only real relationship that she actually gets.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's happening at the end where she's going back home, like going back to the council estates, and like I said, like I think we've said, there's so much of the book through the narrator's mother of this desperation to get out of these council estates, as that's where you cannot be happy.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the book, she's coming back to this place where she shouldn't be happy. And there's this momentary lapse where she feels happy. She can look and see like, oh, this person who, you know, is living in the same flat that she did when she was growing up is happy. And I think she finds some type of solace in that. Mm-hmm. That she can figure out her own life. Mm-hmm. I like that. Like, I like that. Yeah, like trying to find that relationship that isn't based on a transaction. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think in neoliberalism, that is kind of a radical idea to try to find and build relationships that aren't based off of, like, what am I going to get from this person?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. And it's almost like it's the radical notion that we can and should seek out relationships that are non-transactional. And then it's like, it's not a romanticization of Tracy's life by any stretch. Like, up to the very end, we're very painfully aware of how rough life is for Tracy and how, like, her dreams were shattered.
Yeah.
Right? Like, she was on her way to being a dancer. And it didn't work out for all kinds of reasons. It's not the 1930s. Well, 1930s movies weren't exceptionally optimistic themselves, but, like, it's not the 50s movie or, like, the 90s movie where you, at the end of the movie, you go home and everything's gonna be great.
Yeah.
Right? It's not that.
No.
But it's maybe a little bit of the, like, 30s sensibility of, like, life is hard, but we can find joy in it. Right?
I think that's exactly what it is.
We must begin to tell our young. Is the quest that's just begun. When you're feeling real alone, yeah, there's a great truth that you should know. When you're young, gifted and black, your soul intact.
So, like I said, like, familiarity was just such a way that I understood and interacted with this book. And I think one of the things that sort of struck that off for me was one of the very first things that happens in the book. It's basically the opening scene of the book. So, the narrator is sleeping with Lemon, who is actually Aimee's lover, fuck buddy, whatever. Who, like, Aimee is, like, trying to get him a visa and get him to come live with her. Lamine is from Senegal, but he's working in the same West African country that they're working in, and is black. And the narrator is, she has a black mother and a white father. And she goes out that evening and sees an old film that she really liked and watches it on the big screen. And then goes home back to her apartment and spends time with Lemon. And then afterwards, they're in bed together and she decides to show him this scene from this film. And she describes it as, like, because the film is a Fred Astaire film, and she wants to show it to him because for her, it was a really good example of dance. And because Lemon is also a dancer, she wants to get his take on Fred Astaire's dancing. And all of a sudden, for the very first time in her life, this movie that she's loved her entire life, Swing Time, she realizes that Fred Astaire is up there dancing in blackface. And this is what she says. And as the clip played, he sat up in bed and frowned. I hardly understood what we were looking at, Fred Astaire in blackface. In the Royal Festival Hall, I'd sat in the gods without my glasses on. And the scene opens with a stare in long shot. But none of this really explained how I'd managed to block the childhood image from my memory. The rolling eyes, the white gloves, the Bojangles grin. I felt very stupid, closed the laptop, and went to sleep. It could appear as a really small thing, but I guess for me, it was just... It struck a chord with me because it just felt like something so familiar. And the reason I say that is it felt like oh, I've had this experience. Like, I know exactly what this experience is of encountering something that you loved in your childhood and realizing that it is actually seriously offensive. But then for me, what also felt really familiar and like I felt connected to the narrator through this was the fact that she was raised loving culture, cultural forms like, you know, dance movies from the 30s and 40s that were designed in a way where like half of her, like who she was actually erased and disparaged even within this culture. But it was like the thing from her childhood that, one of the things from her childhood that she most loved. And that felt really, really familiar to me. I think it's clear in the quotation that the narrator is more embarrassed about what Lemon thinks of her, but it's also, I think, speaks back to her struggles with her own blackness and other events that happened throughout the narrative. So, like, I felt really connected to this because I am also mixed race and, like, I'm not black, but I also was raised very much, particularly by my brown mother, to love white culture and to sort of not look for brown culture and not look for brown and black people in my heroes. And like this led to us to the point where in my imagination, my characters were always white, and my mental image of every story that I told myself was about white people. And so that just really impacted me. But I think we saw it differently, and I had posed this as a possible topic of conversation, and I think we ended up seeing it differently. So why don't you talk about how you saw it?
So yeah, so you posed it as the question of what do we do when all our faves are problematic? And it's just like, no, that's a really kind of great question, and I think it's a great question that people who become radicalized or start to see the world through a more political lens grapple with, right? And like, I know I did in like kind of two different ways. So one is growing up, I used to absolutely love James Bond movies. I used to own all of them. I could tell you which order they were released in. I could tell you the names of every villain and give you detailed plot rundowns of every single thing that had happened. I used to love it. And then like when you go away, I went to university, I like experienced things, I became aware of like gender and sexism and media, and you go back and you watch it and it's really kind of horrible. Like it's really uncomfortable to watch because like, I mean, I'm just thinking every, especially in the earlier James Bond movies, every time he has sex with a woman, she ends up dead. And it's just like, that's just an okay thing that just happens. Right? Like, it's never discussed, it's never interrogated. So it's just like, it's really uncomfortable. And then I think the other thing for me is sports as well. Like, growing up, I used to love sports. Like, and like, it was just everything. Like sports heroes were always kind of my heroes or the people that I really looked up to as like, this is the pinnacle of sort of life that you should aspire to. So going back to the question of like, what do you do when all your faves are problematic? It's just like, when I kind of started to see all of the different kind of structural racism, sexism, classism playing in all of these things, my instinct was to just go like, fuck it and like burn it all, right? And I just like spent years where like I would ignore it that it was happening and didn't want to pay attention to it and pretended that I didn't love James Bond movies, pretended that I didn't love sports or weren't interested in sports. But then kind of slowly, like after I had that like first sort of like, I don't know, I guess like radicalism moment, if you will, I know what's happening here. I can see the shitty toxic masculinity. This is not a person who I want to be. And it's also like not something that I'm going to share, but I can appreciate that from time to time that I can find pleasure in kind of these shitty narratives. That's kind of how I approach it. But then it's also, for me, it's, I have the ability to find new favorites right now, right? So I can, you know, watch shows like Insecure or Atlanta that, you know, do a really good job of unpacking race and gender and are written by these fucking amazing, like, black actors and writers in the States. and I can watch and I can read like books written by indigenous authors, and I can read books written by like African authors or Latin American authors, and I can find those new favorites, and those are the favorites that I can like push out there when people ask me things that I'm interested in. So it doesn't fall back into just the generic toxic masculinity trope of, oh, I love James Bond and I love sports, because those are the only two things that I allow myself to feel. I can find other favorites that make me feel different things, and those are the things that I can promote and look at.
Mm-hmm. See, and I understand what you're saying. I think this is where, like, maybe my difference or, like, my confusion with what you're saying comes in, because it's like, I think what you're describing has a lot of white privilege and a lot of male privilege to it, mm-hmm. in the sense that, like, you can do both. You get to like these things and find your own favorites, but not have a kind of, like, personal crisis about it. Or you don't appear to have a personal crisis about it. And, like, not everybody who, you know, is a person of color who grew up watching, like, white culture has an identity crisis every time they watch it. I both want to be able to go back to those things and enjoy them for what they are, because they still have meaning to me, because they're part of my history, my history of who I am. They still jar me because they remind me that like my creative imagination was colonized for a really long time. And so like now I can go and find Caribbean authors, and I can find shows but with like black and brown and indigenous characters and shows that are led by women and find pleasure in those. But I can also feel the kind of internal tension and crisis of what it means to have your imagination colonized. In a way that, and so like, I just wonder, like, I'm always curious about how we can push a bit further on white privilege and not just acknowledge its existence, but actually like acknowledge its damage and its like harm and pain. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, this is where my question to you comes from, is like, how does knowing what you know about this stuff and knowing that you love and or loved this stuff, how does that change the way you feel about yourself?
It's a hard question, because like, I'm not forced to think about it.
But that's what I mean. Like, it's a question that is weird to you, but it's a question that I think lots of people like me have to ask ourselves all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, and I appreciate that. And it's just like I don't know. Like, and like, I've been thinking about this all day, and it's just like, I don't know how it makes me feel. Right? Like how knowing it makes me feel. Like, I think there are things where it's like, I'm annoyed that I wasn't exposed to more. I'm annoyed that nobody really ever tried to challenge me about how shitty it was. You know, growing up, like, especially growing up in small town southern Alberta, like, you just, your opportunities to be exposed to new things just don't exist. The idea of white privilege is just something that just doesn't exist growing up. The idea of toxic masculinity is just not something that really existed growing up. I think that's what I feel. Like, I don't personally have that crisis of, like I don't necessarily feel it's like I can feel damage being done to myself. It's more frustration for me that there was nothing else for me there. Because I think you're right. Like, I'm never going to be held to account for enjoying those things, right?
Yeah. Again, like I was saying, I think the tension is important. I do appreciate the way that she is both able to pull from these like cultural productions, that cultural things that were important in her life that have all these problematic things to them, but also be the person who talks about black literature and talks about people of color writing and producing things and creativity in those ways. Like, can do both of those things.
Yeah. And I mean, she also is able, like, so the other way that I was trying to think about this question is that, like, these are histories of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And as much as we don't like these histories of ourselves, they are. And you can't run away from that. You can't run away from the history. So I think, like, during the book, like, especially, like, when she's a child, these old-time movies, like, just, like, that's what they watched, and she loved them and loved them and loved them. But at the same time, so though she might not have seen the blackface, she does see the other, like, black characters, the characters of color in them, and she, like, seeks them out. So I'm thinking there's the one girl who looks, one woman who looks just like Tracy,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, you have this movie full of essentially white people, but she can pull out that one character, and she is so excited when she sees that there is this one other black character who looks like her best friend. Like, she loves dance, so she, like, really loves the history of dance and everything like that. And then she actually sees the dance that Michael Jackson did in the 80s, where you lean forward, I think it's, like, one-third of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And she's so excited about this when she sees this in a movie and, like, actually learns the, like, back history to it, where, like, the dancers who did this dance were only able to do that move by putting...
Who were black.
Yeah, who were black. We're only able to do it by putting nails, like, by nailing their shoes to the ground,
mm-hmm.
and then leaning over. And how Michael Jackson then took that and was able to adapt it by, like, I think it was, he built, like, a flip into his shoe or something like that.
Right.
So, like, it, like, gripped his shoe on to allow him to do that. So I think, like, going back and being able to see that, like, there are always still kind of, like...
People of color
in these shows,
yeah.
that you can, like, embrace in this culture that can actually transform and, like, can bring culture, like, kind of, like, forward, is also a way to go about approaching it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so important because you know, one of the things that white culture is really good at is appropriating stuff that non-white folks do and then pretending they invented it. Like, pretending, you know, we invented it. So, like, being able to go back and show that real history. But, like, I've also heard, you know, Davey Smith talking about, like, the really terrible early movies from the 20s and 30s that actually had portrayals of black characters played by black actors who were, like, these awful stereotypes. But she looks at them and she's like, but they were also really good dancers. And, like, if you watch it for the dancing that they're doing, and she recognizes how awful and horrible and demeaning they must have been for these dancers, for these people working in the movies. But at the same time, their dancing was amazing and, like, needs to be celebrated as, like, really, really good work and really important. The only thing, though, that this makes me think of is the problem of appreciation versus appropriation. Like, one of the things that defines whiteness is the belief that everything in the world is for you, or in some way everything in the world serves your needs and your desires in some way. And so, like, I often worry about finding faves who are folks from marginalized communities or folks, people of color, and remembering not to expect that their work has to make sense to me, right? Or necessarily has to serve my needs or my desires for, like, understanding the world or speaking to my, like, internal struggles or whatever, and how it's, like, important to be able to appreciate the creativity at the same time not expecting it to be for you.
Right, and I think we talked about it in James, not that I think it made the cut in the actual final edit, but it's just like, so with him, it was interesting because there was, like, not a white interpreter in his story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was no white character who was there to make understandable the moments of, like, black people speaking to each other, right? So, like, there was no white character there to explain what certain words meant. There was no white character there to, like, try to help you understand the political context that is happening in Jamaica at that time. It's just like, he's just telling the story and you got to catch up, you got to keep up, and if you don't keep up, well, that's your own fault. There's just something really empowering about seeing that. We're not constantly having to go back to this generic, stale white character to try to understand what's happening over there, where it's just like, you're forced to actually look it up. You might even be forced to stop reading and, like, Google search a word just because, like, you're really confused about what's going on. Like, you're forced to actually do the work of reading, of trying to understand other people.
Yeah, and I think also beyond that, like, you're forced to recognize that you might not be the person who gets the most out of this,
yeah.
this cultural production, or gets mm-hmm. the most out of this creative work. Like, it's
mm-hmm.
not necessarily for you, and it's not necessarily, you're not necessarily going to get the most out of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it just goes back to the conversation we just had, where, like, all our faves are problematic, where, like, for you, you're able to read Zadie, and, like, it's going to come back into a very personal understanding and almost, like, a self-reflexive moment on your own life. So, whereas I'm going to read Zadie, and I'm not going to have that, but I'm still going to be able to appreciate and enjoy the story that she's telling me, and hopefully try to understand a little bit about something else. So when, like, we have a conversation, like, I might be able to have some type of broader context of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, like, I've been spending the whole time talking about how much I love Zadie and how problematic it is to me to talk about her work, because I'm just, like, a fangirl who wants to gush about how wonderful she is. But, like, I think this goes to the main reason for me that is the case, which is that I think more than any other author I've ever read, Zadie Smith feels like she's writing for people like me.
Yeah.
Where, like, I can read her work, and I can read, especially Swing Time, I just felt like I could read this character, read these characters, and be like, this is speaking to me. Not entirely, but, like, it is speaking to a lot of things that I recognize and feel really empowered and emboldened by the fact that it's, like, all these years of reading fiction and having my imagination be focused on white people, being able to, like, have my imagination sort of cultivated and populated with mixed race people is, like, super exciting for me. Like, one of the great things about great liberatory fiction, right, is that it opens these kind of things for us.
Yeah.
And it raises the need to liberate culture and to liberate art and to liberate creativity as much as we need to liberate our economy and liberate our gender relations and all of this other stuff. Like, we need to liberate creativity and continue to do that. There's a light, a certain kind of light, it's never shone on me. Thanks for listening to this episode. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion and that it can help us all in some small way as we look towards liberation. We obviously have lots to say about Zadie Smith. If you haven't already, you should pick up her work. And definitely, I recommend listening to her commencement address at the New School from 2014. Her music in this episode is from the venerable Miss Nina Simone. Face again.